This weekend, we arrive at one of the most magical times of the year, the winter solstice, when the Earth's axis tips farthest from the sun, the shortest day and the longest night of the year. The ancients called this the hinge of the year, a time when we hang suspended between dark and light. I'm Anne Strange-Hemps, and we celebrate the winter solstice this morning with words and stories for the long night. My guest is Phil Cousineau. He's a writer and documentary filmmaker. He was a protege of the great mythologist Joseph Campbell, and he's the host and producer of the PBS series Global Spirit. He's written more than 24 books about myth, storytelling, and spiritual journeys, including, just in time for the winter solstice, a brand new book called Burning the Midnight Oil, Illuminating Words for the Long Night's Journey into Day. Phil, welcome. It's a pleasure to have you here today.
Wonderful. It's 7 a.m. out here in San Francisco, but I'm used to burning the midnight oil even till dawn.
Well, thanks for getting up early. Do you actually have light already?
The light is just starting to peek over the horizon, but there's a beautiful moon at the same time, so it's quite dramatic
as I look out
over the Golden Gate Bridge.
This is that dramatic time of the year when dark and light mingle so much. I'm curious, what does the winter solstice mean to you?
Exactly that. This shift from one world, one dimension into the other. I grew up in Michigan, not too far from all of you, and we had quite long nights, but I was never grieved by them, so to speak. Remember, throughout human history, night has been the time of terrors. For millennia, we were fearful of animals. And then during the Middle Ages, we were fearful of going outside of our door, outside of the castle walls, for fear of marauders. We have been afraid of the dark for most of human history. It's only since the invention of gas lights and electrical lights when we began to befriend it, so to speak. So I've loved it because I grew up in the 50s in Detroit with nighttime radio, listening to Detroit Tigers baseball games and rock and roll music on my little transistor radio, and living within a couple of blocks of the Wabash Cannonball going by our house. So that helped enchant the night for me. And I didn't mind that it was 14 and a half hours long rather than bewail the fact there was only 9.5 hours of sunlight. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Some others would say this is the time of terror, but I loved it because it stimulated my imagination. It always has. And when I look back in history and the mythological symbolism of it, it was always symbolized through festivals like Saturnalia.
Yeah, so many of the rituals and symbols of the winter holidays we're celebrating, Christmas, Hanukkah, New Year's, so many of those rituals and symbols go back, hundreds, thousands of years to the earliest winter solstice celebrations, don't they?
Yes, I've spent a lot of time in Ireland over the years. I lead literary tours there every year, and I've been out in the Aran Islands, over outside the west coast of Connemara in Ireland. And to this day, they set enormous bonfires all over the island on the solstice. And it's a celebration of the end of the terror of night and the beginning of the light returning. And of course, this was transferred to the symbolism of Christ and Christianity, that he was bringing the light out of the darkness. But that's not a new mythology. It's an ancient one, that there has been a tussle, a wrestling match, so to speak, a battle between the forces of good and dark. When you turn the lights on for your Christmas tree, it's actually a distant racial memory of just that, that even in the midst of darkness, there is light. There's hope and everything that goes with that.
There's something so beautiful. I always think just driving through my neighborhood at night these days, all the houses, or so many of them, lit up, the little twinkling white lights on bushes and things. There's something, certainly it feels friendly, but it feels like there's more to it than that. I guess what you just said.
When you're looking at it, it's not just a superficial response to pretty lights on houses. There's something, I think, more profound. It's archetypal. You, your body, your racial memory is celebrating the fact that the world will go on. And I mean that in a profound way, because so much of human death, probably up until the 18th, 19th century, took place during the winter months when life was extremely serious. It was cold without fires. It was cold psychologically because we weren't quite sure until recently that we, our families, the tribe, would even survive winter.
Well, and we didn't have canned goods and supermarkets to go to.
Yeah. Recently, I was interviewing a paleontologist for a project. I'm host of this new show on PBS called Global Spirit. And he has this marvelous idea that fire, the invention of fire, was the greatest invention in human history. We learned some of that in school, but his innovative thought is that with it brought human conversation. As the night stretched on and we lit our fires, we could cook and we would huddle together, but we began to talk. And as we talked and developed conversation, we developed language, and the language enlarged our brain. We began to paint on the very cave walls where we were hiding from the animals and so on. And I believe that there is something of that that stretches into our time.
That's really lovely. Think of it, because during the day, of course, people would have been busy going about trying to hunt animals or whatever they were going to do during the day. And what else would there have been to do at night around the campfire but talk? So I love thinking that shows like this one, a public radio talk program where we invite listeners to join a big public conversation, goes way back. How appropriate that's how we're celebrating the solstice today, with this campfire conversation, so to speak.
And as you know, I'm a word lover. I've been on this show before with my books, Word Catcher and the Painted Word. And in those, I discovered one of my more, delightful etymologies, and that's our word focus, which we talk about so much. We use it if we're athletes, if we're radio hosts, right? Can you focus? Can you focus? It's the old Latin word for the fireplace. And to me, that's an ancient archetypal image, because when we huddled around those fires, what did we do? We stared, right? We still do today. We stare deeply into the fire. We lose ourselves. We become transported with memory. And if we're with others, we begin to talk.
Phil, we're talking about the value of the light, but you know, light wouldn't exist without darkness, right? And one of the themes of your new book, this Burning the Midnight Oil, is about the value to be found in darkness, in the night.
Exactly. I've structured it as a bit of a pun to the great Eugene O'Neill play, Long Day's Journey into Night. Mm. This is a long night's journey into day. I've used this metaphor since my days with Campbell, the hero's journey work. And I came to see it that when the sun goes down, you begin a journey through the night, through some focus, celebration over your meals with your friends and family. But there inevitably will be that dark time, the darkest point of night, called the labyrinth. We say the dark night of the soul, because some anxiety comes up, right? Some loneliness comes up. Edward Hopper, the great painter, said, if I'm pushed, I'll say that all my paintings were about urban loneliness. That's what he was trying to get into those haunting paintings of his.
And isn't that one, the famous one of his, the iconic painting of the people sitting around in the diner, isn't that called Nighthawks?
That's exactly right. I have an entire chapter in here based on that, and that's my notion for people who work late at night, assembly line workers, miners, people in the midnight shift of an auto plant. There's an entire subculture of people who thrive at work, but also some who are forced by circumstances into working through the night. So it behooves us to make a friend.
I have to tell you, I read that, looked at that section on Nighthawks, and instantly flashed on a friend and colleague told me he grew up in Wisconsin, and as a boy there was a camp he went to. He begged to go to it. It's the Night Owl Camp. So this is a camp that they had. It was very smart. During the day, they host day campers. Then there's another camp for kids who come at night, and they come at 6 p.m. and they stay up all night. And they have games in the dark in the forests, and then they go out. They go on trips around town. They go to all night diners and police stations and places where people are working all night.
That's so marvelous. There's, of course, research coming out about this now, and it appears that our suspicion was true all along. There are early birds and night owls, right?
Right.
Some people constitutionally do better in the morning. I met Norman Mailer one night, and he said that writing is no more than getting up at 6 a.m. and putting a seat of your pants to the seat of your chair for 3 hours. That was the mystery.
And did you think, yeah, it's the getting up at 6 a.m. that's the hard part, not the writing?
Well, that's right. Or the hard part for me is staying up all night till I reach 6 a.m. so I can write for 3 more hours. So, yeah, you have to find your own rhythm. And we have a teenage boy, Jack. He's 17 now, and he is a night owl like his dad. My wife is wondering, is this genetic? Is this strange? So she does some research and finds out that most teenagers actually thrive better in the afternoon and the evening. And it's constitutionally tough. It's hard on them to get up and take 8 o'clock classes. And that might be the hint of what you're describing with the kids who are going to the night camp. I have a beautiful entry in this new book, Burning the Midnight Oil, by the Canadian poet Margaret Atwood, who spends an evening in the Royal Ontario Museum. Mm-hmm. It is one of the most haunting pieces I know because she looks at paintings, but also the skeletons of the ancient woolly mammoths. And her interpretation, her vision, her apprehension of these is much different at midnight than it would be in a crowded museum at night.
That sounds like a piece that would have, sounds like a piece that would have inspired that. What was that movie, Night at the Museum?
I wonder if there's a relationship between the two of them.
Right.
I'm a huge baseball fan, and I've come to see and appreciate that across America there are now overnight campouts in a lot of ballparks, where the moms and dads can take a tent and some sleeping bags and sleep in the outfield during the summer, of course. And then they have fireworks, and some of the team players even come out and play catch with the kids at night. So I believe we're slightly turning back to that, to feel, you might say, the velveteen fingers of the night. There can be something friendly, and that's how I look at this book, that the night is still a source of fear for some people. Our lonelinesses, our insecurities can come up at night. But when you open this book, you can see that people from Li Po and the Greek poet Sappho, all the way up through Charles Dickens and Beethoven, Darwin, all night owls, people who thrived at night. Guess what? You're not alone if you'd like the midnight hour, like Wilson Pickett.
We're talking with Phil Cousineau. He's an award-winning writer, filmmaker, teacher, and editor. He's the author of more than 25 books, including his latest, Burning the Midnight Oil, Illuminating Words for the Long Night's Journey into Day. He's here with us this morning celebrating the winter solstice, which happens this weekend. And I'd love to know what the winter solstice means to you. Is this a special time, maybe one that you have organized activities around? Are you a night lover yourself? You can join our conversation, 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or if you're a shy person, you can email us. The address is talk@wpr.org. I'm Ann Strange Champs, and you're listening to 45 North on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time this afternoon, Rob Ferret and Mike Arnold look at the news of the day, learn about figgy pudding, and then talk to a new lobbying group that's advocating for the Upper Midwest. Right now we're talking with Phil Cousineau, who's here celebrating the winter solstice with us. And Phil, we've got some callers on the line. Let's hear from Gary in Ween, Wisconsin. Hi, Gary.
Good morning. Great show. We have a tradition of getting together on the solstice, and we've done it along the Bad River up in the far reaches of northern Wisconsin, and along the Flambeau River by Smith Rapids. Last year we did along the Big Rib River in northern Marathon County, and we're planning a get-together tomorrow. There'll be about 20 to 25 people.
And, Gary, what do you do at these gatherings?
Well, we have a big bonfire in the tradition of calling the sun back, and everybody brings some food to pass around and some adult beverages, and we tell stories, and we do a lot of laughing.
Oh, it sounds fantastic. Thank you so much for calling. And if you're listening and you've got a solstice, annual solstice ritual, call and tell us what it is. 800-642-1234. Phil, do you do anything for the solstice?
I'm still a lover of the Christmas tree tradition, partly because it wasn't as commercial as it was visceral. I would get together with my brother, some friends, my dad. We would drive north from Detroit to old tree farms, and we would cut down the tree ourselves, bring it back, string up the lights. My grandparents used to do old-fashioned things like put little candles.
Oh, real candles?
Yeah. And you think back how dangerous that was, but that was a tradition. We'd weave popcorn on it. All the bulbs were handmade. And the smell of the tree still lights my inner fires, so to speak. And because there is that warm glow of continuity, and I think that's a big part of this, a sense that we have been doing this for millennia, that sparks my interest in doing this now with my son, who's 17. Tomorrow, we're going to drive up to Northern California, and we'll cut down the tree ourselves this year and bring it back and decorate it.
Well, that's what a lot of people here in Wisconsin, which is, of course, a heavily forested state, a lot of us do that. What's the symbolism going way back of the Christmas tree with the lights on it? I mean, we think of it as a Christmas symbol, but it predates Christianity.
Yes, people have been decorating trees since the time of the early Vikings, my goodness sakes, all the way back into Sumeria. The tree, the evergreen, see the lovely name of that, we tend to use evergreens, is this symbol of a kind of hope of continuity again, that there is something that will be evergreen, that life will go on.
Symbol of what's undying.
Undying, beautiful word for it. So the resurrection that has predominated Western culture for 2,000 years is universal. There is this doubt that life may simply flicker out, and the green will turn to brown and never come back. So a little nudge by us, so to speak. I think that's what mythic ritual behavior is about. We nudge things along just in case. We're just covering ourselves, right? That life will come back, but we also sing. We celebrate. We cook for each other. These are all rituals in hopes of celebration. And that's how I look at this book that I've created. It's a handful of friends, so to speak, throughout human history from many, many different cultures. People who have loved the night, but who've also struggled with the night. I have passages from Jack Kerouac here, Miles Davis, who describe how the frightening powers of light, the disappearance of light, have to be resurrected in order to make music, to create literature. There's a lot of hope in a book like this. Ezra Pound once described a poem as a ball of light in your hand. That's beautiful.
That's lovely.
And I'm trying to think of this book like that. It's a ball of light and fire that you can turn to for the entire year.
I want to come back to the connection between creativity and the darkness or the night. But I want to take a couple of other calls. We've got Kathy on the line from Galesburg, Illinois. Hi, Kathy. Hey, Kathy, are you there? Nope, lost Kathy. Let's try Carol in Muscadet.
Yes. I want to put in a plug for the book, The Library at Night, by Alberto Manguel, also a Canadian and a Chilean citizen, and he lives in the south of France, etc. He captures in that book the whole atmosphere of nights in the library, and implicitly that's always contrasted with the light in the books themselves, and kind of gives you the idea, while you're reading this, just enchanted, it's so beautiful, that night is the dreaming time, whether we're sleeping or not, and it's the perfect time to read and write.
Oh, I love it that you brought that up, because you're exactly right. Night is, in many ways, I think the older and busier we get, I think the more we look forward to night. It's the time when we can finally leave the busyness of our outer lives and return to our inner lives, books, dreams, the imagination.
Wonderful. Alberto is actually a friend of mine. I love his work. He's anthologized me, and now I've anthologized him. Thank you to the listener, because I do have an excerpt from The Library at Night in this.
If he's a friend of yours, I have to ask you, there was an article about him when that book came out, The Library at Night, mm-hmm. in the New York Times years ago, and he lives, I guess, in the south of France, I think, but he built the most beautiful library I have ever seen. I think it's in an old, old barn, and it's completely... Yes. Have you seen that library?
It's actually in the west of France, and he's invited me there, and I've come close a couple of times. The invitation is still open.
Oh, my God, you've never gone. Oh, it looks like just the most beautiful library I've ever seen. I would get on a plane just to go there.
Yes, yes. He writes something beautiful in one part of that book in which he says, in the light, we read the inventions of others, but in the darkness, we invent our own stories. Mm. Ironically, darkness promotes speech. That's the heart of a storyteller, someone who reveres books and the way that they can light up our lives, even in the midst of darkness.
Well, and you have to think, if we didn't have darkness and well, I guess candlelight and then on into the later nights, would we have written words, written poetry, stories? I mean, so much of that happens at night, right?
Yes. And then one other element, that's beautifully put. I remember my grandmother used to say to me, Philip, simmer down, simmer down. Do you remember that old expression?
Mm-hmm.
And I've come to appreciate that in the sense that simmering is also a kind of brooding. So during the day, we may have some ideas, inspirations. We do some of the craft work. We work on our skills and so on. But at night, as the world gets quieter and there are fewer distractions, we are able to more deeply focus on the thoughts that came up during the day. And that is when we hone the work. Most creative people will actually use that isolation, that solitude, the quiet, the contemplativeness, to put the ideas on paper. John Updike once said, artists and writers have one thing in common. They love putting black marks on white paper.
That's lovely. Well, we're talking about you as a wordsmith, a collector of words. There's some old words that, I don't know, maybe they're worth bringing back. But one of them I love, noctuary, which is writing. What is a noctuary?
It's a collection of writing about the night. And it goes back to the Middle Ages. And I think it is an expression of this awe. It really is an awe of the numinous powers at night. So there aren't just the fear that the marauders will break down the city gates and come and pillage the place. This is also the time when angels appear, demons. I'm talking mythologically.
Mm-hmm.
And so you begin to put your songs, chants, some riddles, many, many riddles in folk traditions around the world, together in a kind of book, a pamphlet. Early on, it would have been a pamphlet that you read for a kind of consolation in the middle of the night, a noctuary.
Hmm.
That's, in a sense, that's what this book is. It's a collection of inspirational writing about the night. The other word that I'm trying to revive in this book is noctivigate.
Noctivigate?
It's a way to navigate through the night.
Oh, so night walking.
Isn't that fantastic? Charles Dickens was a very famous night walker. He was an insomniac, and several nights during the week, he would be seen walking from one end of London to the other, stewing, steeping, simmering on his ideas so that when he got back to the house, he would sit down and he'd be able to write for hours.
I want to come back to night walking, but let's also hear from Jill. Let's hear from Jill in Clintonville. Hi, Jill.
Hello.
Hi. Thank you so much for calling.
I love this show, and I wanted to just share that I'm a pastor in the UCC in Clintonville, and we're using a curriculum that encouraged us to do our Blue Christmas, a service for people who are lamenting during the Christmas season on the solstice, because it is the longest night, and yet we're heading towards light. And so it's a night in which we're going to bring hope in the darkness to people who are lamenting.
People who are grieving, who've lost someone during the year?
Correct. A variety of losses, from deaths of people they love, disappointments in life, job loss, things like that.
Oh, that's lovely. Is that a tradition? I didn't know about that. Blue Christmas? Is that a kind of growing tradition or movement to celebrate a blue Christmas?
I think churches have been doing it for a while, although, in the Christmas season, everybody wants to be joyous and happy, and we neglect the lament side.
And it can be terribly difficult, I think, especially difficult for people who are grieving those holiday seasons when everybody else is happy around you. You feel so isolated and alone in your grief, and also so you can't really, remark on it too much. You don't want to puncture everybody else's joy, but you can really feel isolated.
It's an intensification of all of our feelings. I have a passage in here about Van Gogh writing a letter to his brother Theo in 1888, in which he's describing the act of painting the famous Starry, Starry Night, and also one night painting the Café de Nuit, the mm-hmm. wonderful night cafe piece, in which he says, "Theo, I think I see more intensely at night. I feel more intensely the colors of the world at night." So this would echo beautifully with this new Blue Christmas tradition of grieving, because all of our emotions come up since the filters of the day, the distractions, the noises of the day have faded away. And whatever in our heart will come up, I believe, much more powerfully if we're not distracting ourselves again by keeping the television on all night.
Right. Well, don't you think
the internet?
Well, don't you think you were talking about earlier about the ancient, almost hardwired fear of the night we have? Don't you think we still fear the night for exactly the reason you just said? The busyness of our life drifts away, and what's in our hearts, or that, the griefs we carry with us that we manage to distract ourselves from during the day, our fears, our worries, all those jump out at us. I mean, that's what every insomniac will tell you. It's not pleasant to be awake at night.
Jump out is exactly the phrase, because Lewis Carroll was a classic character with this. He was also an insomniac and a night owl, and he would describe how characters would jump out at him from the dark corners while he was writing at his desk. And when he finally went to bed, he could only sleep for a couple of hours a night because these characters, these sounds, the snark, the unicorns, and so on, they were live characters for him. And he finally devised something he called a nyctograph, as in night writing. It was a wooden board that he would put on his lap and cover it over with the coverlid. And if he had a word or an image, a voice that appeared to him at night, he realized he couldn't turn on the light because they would all go away. So he found a way to do a kind of early, the Braille form. He would poke holes through the 26 letters of the alphabet, the little boxes, cutouts in the wooden board, so he could puncture paper. And in the morning, he could read an early form of Braille of the appearances, the phantasmagoria that came to him at night.
That's fascinating. It also sounds incredibly time-consuming.
It is, but it's also what someone does if they realize that their most vibrant imaginative life is taking place when the lights go out. Paul McCartney from the Beatles was famous for doing this. Many of his songs came to him in the middle of the night. There's a lovely memory of him waking up once with the first line, "We all live in a yellow submarine," coming to him. Now, most of us would just go right back to sleep, right? What the heck is a yellow submarine?
Uh-huh.
He simply wrote down that one phrase, and when he woke up the next morning, he was disciplined enough to turn right back to the pad and paper, and as he wrote, in a non-pretentious way, this is just casual for him, the rest of the song came to him, and he wrote it in 5 minutes.
Hmm.
And then the joke is, at the end of it, he said, "Well, this isn't a song for me. This is a song for Ringo to sing."
Well, you're touching on the other big aspect of night that we haven't even really talked about, and that's dreaming. The older I get, I don't know about you, the richer I find my dreams. I mean, the more they seem like, a whole other world that I mostly look forward to entering at night, though there are also the occasional nightmares. Do you have any kind of regular dream practice yourself?
Well, since I don't sleep as much as most people anyway, that's the one price I pay. I got on this rhythm working in the steel factories in Detroit growing up in my college years, sleeping 2 or 3 hours a night because I was going to college full-time plus working full-time. And I'm up to about 4 or 5 hours a night now, and that does cut down on your dream life. However, when the visions do come, I have unfailingly, unstintingly, the pad and paper, not computers. That interferes with the dream life too much for a million reasons. So I'll write down a few words, phrases, and images. You don't overwrite it. That becomes too intellectual. But then in the morning, I'll do what McCartney did and others. And it is a daily practice. And my way of thinking about it is a version of what the great painter, the Swiss painter Paul Klee, said when he was asked what is drawing. He said, oh, it's no more than taking a line out for a walk.
That's beautiful.
This is what I do with my dream images, the dream words that come to me. I wake up in the morning and I can look at a handful of these and I take them out for a walk. I see where they want to go. Many of them end up in poems or stories. Sometimes they end up as part of the narration that I might be writing for a film. I'm working on this TV show, Global Spirit, which is shown nationally, and occasionally I'll get stuck with writing something, let's say for John Cleese. He's the presenting host for this. There's a lot of pressure. Mm-hmm. How do you write for John Cleese?
Yeah, Monty Python.
But my understanding is that when we are stuck, snarled, a little bit lost in the labyrinth of our creativity, but maybe our marriage, maybe the workplace, I firmly believe that our dream world begins to sort that out at night.
Mm.
So many of our solutions come from there, and if we pay attention to it, it's a natural way of healing ourselves at night.
Mm. Well, going back to a little bit of our earlier conversation, we also have an email from Camille, who emailed to say that winter solstice is the anniversary of her father's death. He was plagued by severe depression all his life, despite being a very spiritual and religious person. And she says, I've always felt that while his depressive self may have succumbed to death on the longest night of the year, it was his spirit who chose the day of the lights returning. That's really a lovely comment. We're talking about the winter solstice today, about darkness and light, about the long night and the return of the light and day, and about the how to revalue the light. We're talking with Phil Cousineau. He is an award-winning writer, a filmmaker, teacher, and editor. We're talking about his new book, Burning the Midnight Oil, Illuminating Words for the Long Night's Journey in Today. I'd love to hear from you, too. Maybe you have, we've been talking about dreams. Maybe you have a dream practice or a dream group you'd like to call and tell us about, or some other experience of the long night and nighttime activities. 800-642-1234 is the number to call to join the conversation. 800-642-1234. Or, like Camille, you can email us. The address is talk@wpr.org. I'm Ann Strainchamps, and we'll be right back. At 11 this morning, it's Garden Talk with Larry Mueller. On Garden Talk, Larry Mueller learns about the school for beginning market growers and great tips for growing veggies that anyone can use. I'm Ann Strainchamps, and we're talking with Phil Cousineau about the winter solstice, nighttime, and his new book, Burning the Midnight Oil. And Phil, we were talking earlier about night walkers, and I wanted to ask you, I've seen recently there's a growth of a kind of new sector in the tourism industry called dark tourism. This is night tours, ghost walks. They're popping up in hundreds of cities around the world. What do you think you learn or see differently about a city when you see it at night?
Perhaps the essential city. They're at the heart of our most mysterious and magical cities, Berlin, Dublin, Chicago, Paris. It's the nightlife that has attracted us for centuries. But I believe there's another element at work, and that is tourism has become the number one business in the world. It has surpassed the armaments industry. It's that powerful.
That's kind of a really hopeful comment, that instead we're spending more money going out to see and meet each other than we are on weapons to fight each other. I love that.
Do you remember the old prediction in the Old Testament of about turning plows
swords into plowshares, yes.
I believe that's what we're doing on at least a micro level right now, putting down our weapons, at least some of them, and searching, reaching out to others by making plowshares. When we are disturbed by a culture because we feel we're being ripped off by the Chamber of Commerce and we're only seeing the superficial San Francisco, the superficial Milwaukee or New York, I believe that's what's pushing so much tourism down into the hidden. Where I grew up in Detroit, there are tours of the abandoned buildings of Detroit, the old abandoned train stations. There are explorations of the catacombs in Paris. And my reading of it is that many intrepid modern tourists are just fed up with the tourist trap in every sense of that scene. So we look behind the visible. We look into the shadows. We look into the darkness. What's that one? A friend of mine, Mort Rosenblum, he's a reporter for the Associated Press. At one point, he had created this travel company called Adrenaline Travels. We guarantee we can get you there, but we can't guarantee we can get you home again. And he was flooded with offers to go on to join his tours.
Oh, that's really funny. Well, you've got sort of in the book, you kind of list tantalizingly, and then you don't tell us about them, some night walks and night experiences. You mentioned night walks in Paris, an all-night train to the Arctic Circle, and tracking elephants at night in Namibia. Well, tell us about one of these.
Oh, my gosh. All of the above have happened, and many more. I get so enthusiastic. I feel the verve of the road so much, I don't want to sleep. Sometimes I don't even rent a hotel. I'm so excited to be in a place. I just want to be up at night. They used to call nightwalkers night sneaks. Isn't that a wonderful phrase?
Like that, night sneaks.
You're sneaking out of the house, and then you're sneaking around the corner to a late-night pub or a jazz club, whatever it might be. There's that old expression I grew up with in Detroit, that the real life is waiting for us out there somewhere, probably in the dark. So I've spent many nights walking the streets of Paris until dawn because it's such a beautiful city. But I'm taking notes all along, or I'm taking photographs and making sketches. So I'm not just escaping. See, that's often the condescending view of people who are up at night. They're insomniacs and they can't sleep, but that's not quite true. Thoreau loved walking under the full moon because it inspired his writing. I love taking trains at night because there's a whole different feeling of the culture comes over me with that. Tracking animals. I've tracked elephants in Namibia, but also jaguars, tracked in the deep Amazon. That was a heck of an experience.
Yeah, I bet.
All of the noises, every noise that you make when you're walking in a forest is accentuated. And then, of course, your heart begins to pump because you wonder, is that the noise that's going to attract the darn jaguar?
Well, going back to where we began, talking about our primeval, you know, instinctual fear of the dark and fear of being eaten in the dark by another animal. Boy, you'd feel that powerfully at night in the jungle.
Oh, my gosh, I did. Every noise, my imagination went wild thinking that I was going to be attacked by a family of gorillas one minute or a jaguar the next. And yet that same feeling of terror can be tamed, so to speak. I think that's what Lewis Carroll did with his phantasmagorical writing. And there's others. James Agee was a very haunted writer in Knoxville, Tennessee. And he put many of his night terrors into the character of himself as a boy growing up around 10, 12 years old. And the last page of his Pulitzer Prize-winning book, A Death in the Family, I've included in this my book. And I feel it's some of the most beautiful prose that an American writer has ever created. And I can just paraphrase the end of it. The family is gathered together at night to watch the fireworks in Knoxville, and he feels already a bit different from everybody, which all creative people tend to do right around that time. You see colors and paintings, and you feel music a little differently, more powerfully than others. So you see this young boy remove himself. He goes off to the front lawn, lies down on his back, looks up at the stars, and begins to think, I feel different. I will go my own way, and no one will be able to tell me who I am or what I should do. My goodness, it's such a powerful thing for a young boy or a young girl to feel, and that, but that is what happens when we are alone with the quiet of the night and contemplate something like the stars. You know, that's the origin of the word consider. Consider means to con, you're underneath the stars, the Sidious. When you are considering something, it says of being out at night with only your thoughts about the night sky. I love a word origin like that.
Mm. We had a call a minute ago. I think she had to leave, but I wanted to the point she was going to raise, I think, was exactly how I'm feeling, which is she said she's always been afraid of the dark, and listening to us now, she's thinking maybe it's time to embrace it. I'm suddenly realizing, especially listening to you talk about deliberately going out to walk at night, I think I never do that. Ever. I think of night as the time to be in my house, and I love being in my house. I was talking about loving, you know, when I'm home and I can spend time reading or exploring dreams or something. I love that, but it doesn't occur to me to go out and walk through my neighborhood on purpose in the dark, let alone, say, walk into the woods. Do you do that?
Every night. Every night. I live on Telegraph Hill here in North Beach, the old literary corner of San Francisco, and I have a rhythm of doing my editing work, my communications during the day, then I'm with my family at night, and when they go to bed, I'll write for a while, and then I have to take a night walk somewhere around San Francisco. That's where my ideas coalesce, and I have to take a paper and pen because the ideas, they start to come slowly, but the longer I walk, especially in the night, this is such a beautiful city to walk in, they come at me like a Gatling gun. I can barely write fast enough to get all this down. And the old word, the book Alone by the explorer Richard Byrd is, to me, one of the most beautiful books in the 20th century. He goes down to the Arctic Circle as a scientist, and he's going to record what happens in the South Pole, and then he gets a message just as he's arriving that he will be alone for 6 months. The rest of the crew, for one reason or another, can't join him. And he decides that the only way he's going to keep his imagination alive is to do his scientific work in the station, but then walk and observe. He calls them his OBS, O-B-S, which I found out is an old Scottish word for observations. And
that's...
I've used that now. I have a little section in all of my journals for my OBS.
Well, I'm going to go to a call. We've got Tom on the line from Green Bay. Hi, Tom.
Yes, I would. I agree with you very much at night, going out and doing things and even observing nature. There's a wonderful book that was written by a Wisconsin author, Dr. Fran Hammerstrom.
Oh, sure. She's
She's been on your show many times with June. Yes.
With Jean Ferraca.
Yes. And she wrote a book, Walk When the Moon is Full. And it was about her taking her kids out every full moon and walking in the woods and observing and hearing nature, you know, woodcock in the spring and all sorts of things and owls in the winter. And even in the snow, and it's a wonderful book for kids.
Oh, that's just great. Thank you.
Oh,
we've also
wonderful.
Got we've also got Rich on the line from Summers in Wisconsin. Hi, Rich.
Hi.
Hi.
I just wonder if you could put me in a direction. Possibly, I have a nephew's son that is about 10 years old, and he's blind, and he's always in the darkness, and now he's not really liking it. You know, he's getting to realize other things in life, but are there any of your books in Braille that could possibly help him out?
Well, I have several audio books. At least five of my books are in audio, which I'm told has helped many people who cannot see in the ordinary way. When one book I did with a religious historian, Houston Smith, I believe is in Braille. You'd have to go to my website to see which is which. But even if someone is blind, I still recommend going out at night with someone, of course. But the world feels differently to the human touch because there's a little moisture in the air. The wind feels different. I believe that you can actually, people are sensitive, they can even feel the moonlight. There's a spectacular book by Jacques Lucerne called And Then There Was Light. He was blinded suddenly in 1 hour when he was a boy walking in the French countryside, 6 years old. He walked out of the house perfectly able to see, came back into the house completely blind, and he became the head of the French resistance recruiting movement.
Even though he was blind.
Paris. Because he had developed this uncanny ability to read people's characters as they walked into the room and sat down in front of him and began to speak and tell him why they wanted to work with the French resistance.
Wow.
He couldn't see them, but he could feel them. He could read and judge their character.
Okay, I know people are going to ask, so his name was Jacques Luceron?
That's right.
L-U-C-E-R-O-N, probably. Okay.
L-U-S-S-E-Y-R-A-N-D. Okay. The book has just been reissued by New World Library, and the family has finally decided to have it turned into a movie. It's one of the most inspirational books of our time. Under the most deleterious circumstances, the Nazis have occupied Paris, and here a young blind man, he's in his early 20s, had developed such an uncanny, as he put it, and this is the whole point of the story, he trusted the inner light that was within him, and he cultivated it just like we might burn that midnight oil or stoke a fire. So this is what I would tell your young friend who is literally blind, that there is always an inner light that can be worked.
Thank you. That's lovely. I want to also hear from Jerry in Baraboo, who might also have a book recommendation. Hi, Jerry.
Yes. I have a book named Sleep by Anthony Silvestri and illustrated by Anna Horace. And it's a beautiful, beautiful children's book. It's to sit there and on the edge of the bed and read this to your children as they're going to sleep and trying to help them understand, yes, you are going to have some different things happen to you while you sleep. And I could start the book. It starts, "The evening hangs beneath the moon, a silver thread on darkened dune. With closing eyes and resting head, I know that sleep is coming soon.
That's
upon
lovely.
My pillow, safe in bed, a thousand pictures fill my head."
Jerry, thank you. That's really lovely. You remind me the other part about night and sleep. When you're a parent trying to persuade your child to sleep, to be willing to go into the darkness, to be willing to trust the darkness. You know, from the time we're little, often we fight and struggle against that.
Yes. Did anybody sing the old Irish lullaby, Turillurillurai, to you when you were young? Maybe a grandparent, an aunt or an uncle. Do you remember that one?
I remember that one. Unfortunately, no one sang it to me, but I do know that song.
Well, we'll have to get a good recording for you. There's a good one by Van Morrison, which is always a reliable source for Irish music. Anyway, I found out recently, because I lead these literary tours to Ireland as well, that Tura, T-U-R-A, is the old Irish word for a pilgrimage. And what that lullaby, literally it's a way to lull our children to sleep, coax them, not force them, slap their hand, but you've got to go to sleep. No, you lull them into sleep.
Well, and what
the Irish idea is that it's a journey. So what you're doing with singing that song is you're sending them off on their journey into the land of Nod, as Robert Louis Stevenson called it, and you're wishing them a safe journey so that they will arrive with the morning sun.
I love that, and it's just such a perfect way to kind of encapsulate everything that we've been talking about, seeing night not as something to fear, not as something to run away from, but as a place we can journey into, especially at this solstice season.
Wonderful. A line came to me from a dream. The morning I was supposed to turn the manuscript for this book into my publisher, it's a dream line that I squeezed into the galleys at the last minute. And I hope it helps. And it goes like this: if you look long enough into the dark, you will see everything. And I've been meditating on that for a while. I look with all the lights out and no sound at all, and I trust the night, and I trust those voices and the visions. And in some uncanny way, I learn to see all over again by staring deeply into the darkness.
Phil, thank you so much for being with us here on the longest night of the year.
Wonderful. It's been such a pleasure.
Yeah, same here. Phil Cousineau is an award-winning writer, filmmaker, teacher, and editor. He's the host and producer of the PBS show Global Spirit, and we've been talking about his brand new book, Burning the Midnight Oil, Illuminating Words for the Long Night's Journey into Day. There's more 45 North coming up after the news. I'm Ann Strain-Champs, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.